Okay, before we get started today, any questions about what you have coming up? Yes, sir. So the question was, for the individual contest, can we use prefab components? I'm going to ask that a little bit more generally. For the entire contest, can I use prefab components? Yes, provided they fall under the $100 budget, don't include any kind of external actuation or energy. So provided that prefab object fits all the remaining rules. So I think it's to your advantage to get stuff that's already made as much as possible. Just make sure it satisfies all the other requirements in terms of energy, price, those size, those kind of things. Yes? Can you have a trigger mechanism? I'm not exactly sure what you mean. Yes, I think you probably have to do something like that. The exact mechanism is up to you. I think the bounds on what it can look like are based on the size requirements. Remember, you can't have any spring or elastic potential energy for individual contests, and it's all mechanical for the individual. So if you're satisfying all those requirements, then your mechanism's wide open. So ahead. Yeah. So the question was, what's the budget for the individual? So all rules are in play, so you have $100. And that is the as-built cost. So you can go out and spend $1 million if you want. I don't recommend it. But as long as it takes less than $100 to build what you are competing with.
So $100 just for that car, not the total?
So the $100 budget, just to clarify, is not how much you spent over the course of the project. It's how much it would take to build that device.
Okay.
Right? As built. So things are prorated, remember? So if you buy a 8-foot 2x4 and use a foot of it, you can count 1/8 of the price of that 2x4. All right. And it is, again, it is as built price, and it's as built for any Joe Blow off the street, right? So if your uncle has a high end machine shop that does titanium work or something, you can't get free titanium and say it costs you nothing. Like, it's what it would take anybody, kind of random person off the street, to make your device. Does not include the components of the kit, as rule probably 15-ish in the handbook says, in the full rules. Yeah.
Now, we're building this contest robot. This is just building the robot. Nothing is just building the robot, not custom requirements, not.
So the contest is separate from that. You remember, you do have reporting due for this coming up pretty soon too. I think it's the end of next week, right? So preliminary contest is on Tuesday. You have, I think it's preliminary project problem understanding reports due Friday, right? Is that right? That's for the full contest, right? So that's things get busy. Just to warn you, it gets busy for you guys. It gets busy for us too, for the rest of the term, right? The rest of it goes pretty quick. I would say, yeah, those things are not, what you have in that report is not strictly for the individual contest. That's for the entire project. But it's, those reports are kind of timed out and try to time them out so that what you learn in an individual contest can help you understand the problem better for the full contest.
Okay.
Right. So it's kind of, that's why the timing of those reports fall the way they do, and that these individual, I got you. Individual contests are hopefully helping you learn and understand the problem better as you're getting towards the final contest.
Okay.
And using those in that design process. Yes, sir?
Is the area above the trash can considered part of, like, does the keychains have to fall in, or is it like the robot, or like anything above the area?
Sure. So the question is, what about the center section? Does it have to be in the center section or above it? Who's got an answer for that?
Above
is fine for which part?
Start zone is considered space.
Okay. Sounds like you're on the right track. So for the outer, the trash can, cutoff trash can, the outer rim, the volume of air above it counts. Okay. For the inner zone, to get the vibranium points into the inner zone, they have to be in it in general, with the exception of the individual contest. Right. So that's spinning after a week from today, that guy's going to be spinning, and to get those the high level points, you have to be inside vertical dimension two. For the individual contest, we count that entire inner cylinder and the air above it, because you are doing just a mechanical design. Okay, that clear to everybody? That differentiation? Yes. So the arm with, so for this week, you would get the inner, if you struck out some kind of arm somehow over the center and held the keychains, the vibranium above the center, inside the inner cone, you'd get the inner zone points. After a week from today, you would only get the outer zone points, because even though you didn't get inside the inner, you still are inside the outer, if that makes some sense. Yeah. To get the full high level of points for the inner zone, you have to get them in the vertical dimension too. Yes, sir.
So basically, for just for the inner room, it's okay for keychain to hover above the drum, but for resonant, it has to be physically either on the drum or inside to get the.
Not quite. So remember, we're talking about that inner zone points right now. So to get the inner zone points, that center section is rotating, you have to get inside that slot, vertical dimension too. Okay. The outer ring, you get a slower level of points if you get within that outer ring, right? So if you're within the outer ring in any way, but not in the inner zone, you get the outer ring points, whether you let go of them or not. So the only zone, the other way to think about this is the only zone on the track where the vertical dimension matters is that inner zone. Everywhere else, it's the zone and the air above it. It's the actual ground plane truth, and the air above it is the zone. Except for the individual. Yes.
If we use a ramp for our individual contest, does that have to fit within the confines of the rules of like 1 by 2 feet and 2 feet?
So the question is, if you use a ramp or some other separate part, maybe, does that count for the volume of robot? Is that ramp part of how your device operates? Yes. So then is it part of your device? So then is it subject to size requirements? Yes, there you go.
So that would be placing a device on the ramp and measuring it.
Yeah, so in that case, exactly right. So he says that would mean that you have to place your device on the ramp, box it to measure it, and it has to be able to sit there statically. The whole thing counts as your device. Yeah. Could you share a ramp? Yeah, I'm not sure how we would police you not sharing ramps, so sure. If you all come with the same ramp, I will mock you and be deeply disappointed and go home and cry. But there's not, it's not in the rules, so. Other questions? Okay, let me get plugged in over here. Okay, so there we're going to keep marching through today and Thursday. Actually, one more piece of business. You should have got an email from me 3 hours ago about, actually maybe 2 hours ago, with a survey to vote for what times to rank the available some times throughout the week that the lab would be open. If you want your vote to mean something, get it to me by 8 p.m. tomorrow. At that time, we'll decide which of those hours we will have the lab available. Historically, we've had between 12 and 17 hours every week available. Those times will remain constant from whenever they start this week, which will likely be Thursday evening or Friday, depending on how you guys vote, through the final contest. Yes, sir?
You have it from 1 to 13. Would that 1 being the best and 13 being the worst?
Yes.
Okay.
Was there a hand over here somewhere I saw? Yeah. No, so like I said, historically we've had between 12 and 17 hours a term. Haven't quite worked out exactly what we're going to have this term. It depends a little bit on which ones you guys want and what they add up to. And what, and then we'll kind of look at that and look at what we're able to do and match up as best we can. Yes? Okay. So we're going to continue today and then part of the time on Thursday. I think at minimum on Thursday, even if we don't have the open hours Thursday evening, we'll probably walk over in groups over there to give a short run through of the track to everybody so that you get the instructions. We'll talk a little bit about it today, how it works. But we'll keep working today and at least in probably part of the time on Thursday. On Thursday, we'll also very likely hand out, or we will hand out the kits to you guys. So each of your teams gets a kit of stuff. We'll get those and talk about how to use those, the components in that kit. Before we do all that, we had in-class exercise 7, ended up last week. And the instructions were to attach a potentiometer and then have the servo angle, attach a potentiometer servo and have the angle of a servo track the angle of the potentiometer. How many of you guys figure this one out? I saw a few folks before we left even last week. Okay, good number. For those of you that didn't, I just posted this code not too long ago, maybe a half hour. Let's talk through it. So the setup, this is kind of the setup portion of my script here. We have to define our servo that's attached. I'm defining a couple global constants that define the range of the servos. I have 75 to minus 75. That's probably going to be much better behaved if it's 60 to 60. Plus or minus 60 or plus or minus 45 is even better. Right? Remember that those servos behave less well the closer you get to their extreme edges. Right? So if you want the servo to be reliable, operate it about its center if you can. Right? So that's all set up for the servo. Define those angles. And I have my potentiometer plugged into pin X22 using that kind of our standard setup. Okay, so the... In this case, the potentiometer is wired just like it was in the potentiometer example from 2 weeks ago now, I guess. And the servo is wired just like it was wired in the servo example. In the GitHub repository, let me show it to you real quick. Show you my local version. Look, there'll be a folder, stuff there, and then a drawing of the actual connection. Most of those scripts in that GitHub folder have the circuits drawn out as well for you to be able to use it directly. Okay. That's all the kind of setup portion of it. So before we look at the kind of algorithm, let's talk through it together. Okay. What's the algorithm here? What I want the servo to do is track what the potentiometer is doing. So if I'm moving potentiometer right to left, I want the servo output to kind of move with it. Okay. So what does that require algorithmically for us to do? Anybody? Sure. So the kind of, he says the output of the potentiometer becomes the input of the servo. I think at the highest level that's exactly right. Right? So the output of the potentiometer in some sense relates to its angle. Right? Remember, it changes resistance as it's rotating. Okay? So if you can get the angle of the potentiometer, the servo, if you remember, the servo has a command that's just angle. Okay? So what does that require you to do then? I have the servo, I have a range of numbers that tell me where it's at in its range. What do I have to figure out then? Right, so I have to map, exactly right, I have to map, I have 0 all the way to one side to 495 all the way to the other side for that potentiometer, right? That's the theoretical range. It's usually a little bit smaller than that. But I have to figure out at what value of ADC maps to what angle of that potentiometer. Everybody understand what I'm saying? Right, as I turn that potentiometer, remember that ADC value, or the analog voltage, equivalently, changes from its minimum value to a max, or max to min, right? I have to take and understand that that maps to some kind of angle, and then take that angle and give it to the servo. Okay. So what I did, if I have all this wired up, is actually write what is basically a y equals mx plus b solver for that information. Okay. So I know that one end of the potentiometer should be zero, right? All the way lowest voltage. One end of the potentiometer range should be 495, 0 to 3.3 volts. So I take and just map that between the max and min servo angle that I defined before. Okay. So this function does that. I call it pot ADC to servo angle. It tells me exactly what this is doing. Right? It's making that conversion. Probably even better name would be convert pot ADC to servo angle. Right? It takes this input, a variable called ADC value. Which you'll see how we use that in just a second. Okay. And you see here, I have kind of a doc string formatted comment that tells us exactly what this is doing as well. Okay. Again, be in the habit of doing this so that when you get ready to use this 3 weeks from now in your final project, you can look back and know how it actually works rather than having to rewrite it again from zero and try to understand it. Okay, so trip me up. Okay. So all I do is use those two ranges, right? I have a kind of min servo angle, min potentiometer, max servo angle, max potentiometer, 2 points. I can draw a line between them, right? That's all we're doing. That's all this function does, right? Kind of like we did for the force-sensitive resistor to get brightness, right? So I do that, make that calculation, calculate the angle from that, and just return angle. Okay, so here's a function that I've defined to make that do that curve fit effectively for me, or that equation of a line. Then I use that function this way. Okay. So I read the potentiometer, right? Then I pass in, remember this value that gets returned from ADC read is 0 to 495. Right. So I take that value I read and pass it to my function that I just defined, and it does those calculations and gives me back a desired angle for that servo. Okay. And then after printing out kind of what's happening, I just tell the servo to move to that desired angle. Okay. I sleep 10 milliseconds, go back up, and loop again. So I'm just doing this forever. Okay. Questions about that? Those of you that got this working, much different than how I did it? Yes? No?
A little?
The way I solved it is a little simpler, but
okay.
More relevant information. I don't have the print commands.
Okay.
I didn't use as complex of a setup.
Sure. Did you do the kind of linear mapping, though, like we did, or did you divide? Okay. Sure. Other folks that got it working, did you do it much differently? Not really? Okay. Right, so I'm working on the potentiometer value, right? You could convert this to voltage and do a similar function on the voltage if you wanted. Right. I didn't feel like here that step was really necessary because I don't really care what the voltage is. The ADC value gives me enough information to get the angle, for example. Yeah.
So if you wanted to add another potentiometer and servo, how would you implement
that? Sure. So that's going to happen back here. Right. So you would need to change the pin where it's plugged into. Yeah, so if you remember the servo code, you have those kind of four special servo places that are X1, X2, X3, X4, if you have the normal Pi board, are just pyb.servo1234.
Okay.
Right? And then you have X22, 2, 3, 4, 5 down at the bottom of your board are all those shielded ADC inputs, which are the ones you should use first.
Would you change the
You have to change this guy, right? Because this is going to have to have a unique name for each sensor. Okay. And then if all your servos are the same, these could be the same. Okay. So if you had different angles for different servos, you'd have to have different values for each servo. No, so actually, let's back up. I can show that. Let's see. It's over there. So let's see. Geometer. So each potentiometer is going to need a voltage of positive 3.3 in ground. Yes. All those analog sensors need that, right? So if you want to use more than one analog sensor, one kind of probably best way to do that is to run these guys over to one side of your breadboard.
Oh, okay.
And then connect them up to your kind of power rail of your breadboard to here.
Okay, and then you just have to change the...
Then this blue wire would come from which each of those sensors... To actually, it's 19, 20, 21. Sorry, the other way. So it's these four
would be
the blue wire equivalent for each of your analog sensors. And you just have to change the pin number in the ADC setup piece. We have an example probably Thursday where we'll look at how to plug in multiple sensors, basically.
Okay.
But basically, remember, all you have to remember there, these two guys are power, analog, the kind of analog, positive, and ground. So all the sensors would need that, right? So you could run to the power rails, or you could connect them ground to ground in your breadboard. So as long as they're electrically connected, however you just choose to do that, that's up to you, right? But each one of them does need an independent signal wire. And I would suggest, again, 19, 20, 21, 22 as the first four to use. No, those are different.
Okay.
So it's just these two guys here. But you could plug in there and there and be connected red and black.
Okay.
Or you could run red and black to the kind of power rail part of your breadboard and then run cables up there. It's not going to break a sweat at all reading four analog inputs, no. Other questions? Kind of hits on a little bit like what we're going to talk about today in terms of you have so far what we've been looking at is each one of these systems kind of in isolation. You have all the puzzle pieces already, basically, to do everything except control the little bit better motors we're going to give you next week or Thursday. Right? All the sensors are, you have all the sensors you have are analog sensors. Right, you've used the force sensor, the resistor, the flex sensor, the potentiometer. Right, the IR sensor we're going to get on Thursday is just another analog sensor. Right, you have buttons in your kit. Right, so you have all the sensing code you need already. You have all the puzzle pieces. Right, it's just a matter of putting them together in the right way to make a pretty picture. Okay. Okay. One thing to do so is we're going to have to worry about timing. So this is kind of a common question. You start out this way. If I'm piecing these things together and I want to read the sensor and then wait 1 second before I do this, or those kind of run this motor for a little while and then do something else, how do I time all that together? Right? The sequence of events is critical. So one way we've already seen are these various sleep functions. Right? They come in that time module. So I could do time.sleep, and that the unit you give there is seconds, right? I can do time.sleep_milliseconds, and then the number you pass in that function is milliseconds. And then there's time.sleep_microseconds. The number you pass there is microseconds. Okay. This is kind of the simplest way to make things wait. Okay. The downside to this is that these sleep family of functions do sleep the processor. Meaning it's not doing anything else while you tell it, when you tell it to sleep. Okay. It's not reading sensors. It won't be changing motor speeds. You tell it to sleep for a second, it's just sitting there. It's going to sit there and do nothing for 1 second. Okay. Everybody clear on that one? That's a common mistake. That, oh, I'm trying to do stuff while it's, why is it sleeping all the time? Well, that's what you're telling it to do. Yes. 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 This is just seconds, yeah. Yeah. And of course, you could sleep 1,000 milliseconds and it's going to be 1 second too. Right. So critical thing to remember here, the processor, the system is going to sleep. That's why it's called sleep. It's not going to do anything else while it's sitting there telling you to sleep. It's not going to read any sensors, not going to take input from your user, not going to print anything out. It's sleeping. Okay? So we need something a little bit more complex than this, because what we want to do is probably more complex than just sleeping all the time to time our stuff out. We have these time comparison functions. I know that's a lot of words right now, but we'll walk through an example in just a second. You can also get the current time, right, to the millisecond or microsecond using time.ticks underscore millisecond or time.ticks underscore microsecond. Right? This is not the wall clock time. Right? This is the time kind of like since the board's been turned on. This is one way to think about it. Not quite that, but that's kind of a close enough approximation. So it's just giving you a number of seconds that have elapsed since some arbitrary time in the past. It's kind of probably the most concise way to think about it. And it gives it to you either in milliseconds or microseconds. Okay. To do math using those terms, there's some special kind of help with you, help for you in terms of using that those special units effectively. Time.ticks add. So you take two of those units, two of those measurements of time and add them together. Or more specifically, you can take a unit of time and add some delta t time. If I want something to be 300 milliseconds in the future and in the proper format to be able to do this time math on, I can set that up with time.ticks add, kind of current time plus 300. Right. Key point here is you have to match the units that your ticks are in. Okay. So if you did a ticks milliseconds or ticks microseconds here, the delta you get better be in microseconds. If you did a ticks microseconds to get this ticks value, you want your delta value to be in microseconds. Okay. To get the difference between two times, it's time.ticks diff underscore diff. And this is kind of time one minus time two. Okay. In a relatively large number of cases, you could do straight math. However, that's going to be a bug that will come up and bite you and look weird, and you won't be able to figure it out the next time through because the times will be different. So to avoid all that, just always use this if you're doing time on math, math on time. Okay. Ticks add, ticks diff. Okay. You can look. The whole time module has some extra information. Okay. Actually, let's take a look at that, and I'll maybe walk through how to parse a could be useful. Oops. Let's go over here. So there's that link I just, it's on that page. A lot more information if you want to nerd out and see exactly where that time's coming from. It's that, all the sleep functions we just talked about. Okay. So basically, that ticks millisecond you get back is actually a counter that's set up with the processor. So every millisecond that goes by, it adds one to its counter. Right. So the ticks add. You see there, here are their examples. So I can add, I can get my current time and then say what was 100 milliseconds before right now in terms of that ticks parameter. Right. Or this is probably a common one that you'll see. Is I can set some kind of deadline time, right? So I'm going to add 200 milliseconds. Make this a little bigger. I'm going to add 200 milliseconds to the current time, right, via the ticks add, and save that as, hey, that's my deadline time in this ticks format, okay? And then basically, while the difference between my deadline and my current time is greater than zero, do something. So these time comparisons let you do something for a certain amount of time pretty easily. Okay. Okay. Ticks diff, they also set up and show some pretty common examples of how to use this. So this is a pretty common one. So I define in this case in microseconds, right? So I get the start time, probably what I would have called that variable. Start time is time.ticks microseconds. It's going to return to you the number of ticks in microseconds right now. Okay? So that defines when you get to that piece in the code, that's where time it is. Okay? And in this case, hey, we're trying to get when this value of that pin goes to zero. But if the difference between my current time and the start time is greater than 500 microseconds, this is going to raise a timeout error. So it's going to say, hey, you waited too long to do this. Like, I didn't get that button press in the right amount of time. I need to move on, effectively. Right, or it's gonna, in this case, raise an error. And this would print out to your REPL timeout error in line, whatever that was. Okay. So I think for you, this is a really common construction. I'm waiting for my sensor to be read. So for example, you have a button on the front of your, effectively, you can put one of your push buttons on the front of your machine. Right. And when it smacks into the trash can, you know you're at the trash can. Right. And maybe you wait for that button to be read for 3 seconds. You just think it takes you about 3 seconds to get to the center, to smack the center. But if it takes longer than 3,000 milliseconds or whatever to get to the center, then continue with my code anyway. Something to that effect, right? So you can use this timing stuff as a fallback if you're using sensor readings. Another example. So if the center section is turning, you're going to get an IR sensor, right? You can get some information about when that hole comes through. But if I don't get the correct reading after 20 seconds, I probably want to try to drop the torpedoes or the vibranium anyway, and then back away and get out. So the timer doesn't run out. Right? So I think anytime you have, it's really common if you have some kind of sensor-based output that you might have a fallback on, okay, if a certain amount of time elapses, I'm going to do what I was supposed to do anyway, even if I didn't get the right sensor reading. So this structure here is basically what you need to do something like that. Okay. So with that said, I'll let you work from that page. We have another in-class example. Okay, it's kind of just basic time calculation. So you're going to connect the push button. If you really want, you can use the onboard one, but we're going to use the push button in the next in-class example, so you might want to go ahead and connect it. Okay. When your board starts up, the green LED should come on, okay, letting you know that green's kind of go. All right. When you press the button the first time, it should turn on the red LED and turn off the green LED, and you should start a time counter, effectively. All right. When the button's pressed again, you turn off the red, turn on the green, and print out the time between those two button presses to the REPL. Everybody understand what you're going to do? Okay, give this one a shot. Okay, so let's take a small break and see if we can agree on a good algorithm to do this. All right. Remember, I think that's going to strongly recommend, we actually had quite a good discussion in my research group yesterday about this exact same thing. Strongly recommend that you separate out developing your algorithm from writing the code. Right? Because if you don't understand, if you don't have a good algorithm, it doesn't matter how pretty your code is or understand the syntax or not, you're not going to be able to write good code. If your algorithm is junk, doesn't matter what your code is, right? So what we want to happen, just to walk through it, make sure we all understand it again, is when the board comes on for the first boot up, you're going to turn on the green LED. I chose green because green kind of means go, I'm ready to operate. Right? We talked about using those onboard LEDs to let you know program operation. That's kind of one way you can do that. So when that button is pressed, what I want to do is turn the red LED on and the green one off. Okay? True is red because, hey, now you have to push it to stop. So green kind of start timer, red stop timer. Kind of why I chose green and red. Okay? So the second time you push the button, you're going to turn off the red LED, turn the green one back on, and then print how long it took between pressing the button the first time and pressing the button the second time. Okay? So what's the algorithm to do that? Okay, so the first part, what do I have to set up in the kind of the setup part of this piece of code? Yeah, so you have to define kind of red LED, green LED. What else? Yeah, the pin of the how you have the button wire, external button. Okay, so that's kind of the setup part of it. All right. So I think a while loop for the process because you want to just keep doing this forever, effectively, right? So you're kind of one of those while true type things there. Okay. When the push button is pressed, right, I want to turn on LED, turn off the green LED. I think that part's pretty straightforward, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yep, so you have an if. If the button is pressed, whatever, how you read that button, then I can do this stuff with these LEDs. What else do I want to do when the button's pressed? Get the current time, probably. Right. So if I save, I get ticks dot something there. Milliseconds is probably appropriate. If I save the current time when the button's pressed, I can compare it when it's pressed the second time and get the difference. Right. So you can set up some variable, first press time equals time dot ticks underscore milliseconds. And you'll get the number of ticks that when you press the button the first time. Okay, so that's kind of the first piece of it. What else do we need to do? So turn the LEDs, right? When do I want to... I'm trying to ask it generally, so I don't just give it to you. When do I want to run the timer? Or when do I want to be calculating time effectively? Between those presses, how do I know that I'm kind of in that between phase? It's not pressed. Well, you can think about this. If the button has been pressed to turn the LED green, then I want to wait for another press and calculate the time. Right? If it hasn't been pressed the first time, let's say, I'm not trying to calculate the time and count the time. Right? So if we word it that way, if the push button is pressed, then do this stuff. Then if it's pressed again, do some other stuff. What does that tell you your loop should be, your construction could be? You could have these nested ifs inside that while loop. There's one way to do this, right? So your first if is just looking for the first button press. Then it gets inside and have another while loop that's looking for the second one. When the second one's pressed, then it breaks out completely and finishes. Okay, that's one possible way. Right? But I think... I would, again, strongly recommend that you sketch out on a piece of paper or just in plain English what you think the algorithm needs to be before you write a single line of code. Because, again, if you don't get the algorithm right, then it doesn't matter if you got the code syntax right or not. Okay. So keep hammering at that for a minute, and then we'll chat about it. Okay, so this one seems to be giving you guys a little trouble. So since we had some requests for some live coding earlier on, let's do some live coding. So all I've done so far is basically take the digital input script and copy it and rename it into a different folder. Okay, so let me change this so I know what it is later. And I'll expand upon these comments. This is exercise 8 created. So I import the PYB, import time, I set up my pins. I'm going to say my button's going to be connected to X4 like it is an example. Okay. And we get down to the checking. And I know if I get there, I want the green LED to be on. Okay. And then I'm in this while loop, I'm going to read the state of the pin. And because this is that push button code, we already have the kind of if-else set up if it's reading the button or not. So if the button is pressed, right? I know input state is 1 or true. So there's the stuff I want to do the first time, right? So then I'm going to create a variable called start time. And I'm just going to do the milliseconds version of this ticks command. So it should be time.ticks, sorry. Dangers of live coding. Time ticks.ticks milliseconds. That's going to get the current time in that ticks kind of unit. Okay? And then I want to turn the okay, so we're going to output, hey, we started the button to press. The red LED should tell us that too, but we're going to know. Okay. If the button's not pressed, I don't really want to do anything, right? I just want to check it again in a little while. Right? So I'm just going to get rid of that for now. Okay. What's that? Yeah, I got rid of it because there's nothing I want to do if the button's not pressed. I just want to check it again sometime later. Right? In this case, I'm sleeping 100 milliseconds. Okay. So one way to get at a code of any significant complexity is we have something here that should, when it starts up, turn the green LED on, get the value of the pin, and depending on the pin, turn these guys on and print that out. So if you get this and you get some kind of compartmentalized piece of the thing working, test this before you move on. Make sure this piece is working. Right? Okay. I'm not going to do that, though. Okay. So so once we press the button the first time, what do we want to do? We want to wait until it's pressed the second time, basically. Right? We want to check it again, check its state until it's pressed again. Well, what does that look like? Well, it looks kind of like this. And the one piece that we want to, you're going to learn, or the kind of learning through this exercise, is this break command. And what this break will do is say, hey, I was in a while loop. I want to pop out of that. Another way to do this is while, probably a more elegant way, which I'm going to advocate. We call it button timing. So when the button's pressed, I know I'm going to start timing. So while I'm kind of timing the button, this loop will keep running. And as soon as I press the button again, I set that to false, which when it goes up to check the if, the while statement, this wouldn't be true anymore, so it bounces back out to the outer one. Okay. And then we're going to sleep 100 milliseconds between all of that. So what we say, let me subtract, make it a little smaller so we can get the whole kind of logic piece of this code together. Okay, our main outer while loop is looping and looping and looping, checking for a button to be pressed the first time. Okay. Green LED is on the whole time. Okay. So input state's reading the value. If the button is pressed, which is what this if input statement means, it grabs the current time and saves it in the start time variable, handles the LED, prints some stuff out, and sets the button timing variable we've defined here to be true. So we know we're kind of in button timing mode, if you will, because that's true. Then we have a while loop within that if, because this we only want to run this if we had pressed the button the first time. While we're in that kind of button timing mode, read the value of the button. If it's pressed, get the current time, handle the LEDs, calculate the elapsed time, and then we, of course, need to print that out. Elapsed in this while loop. You probably want a short pause in that while loop too, while we're checking the button each time through. Let's change this one to 10 too. This is going to work. Somebody help me out. Who's checking it for me? I think the logic makes sense. Everybody see the kind of algorithm I'm proposing here? I think there's probably a more elegant way to do this. But this, I think this is going to work. Yes, sir.
I got a question. You said earlier that when you put the time sleep function, like the command in, the board stops doing everything. It just sleeps.
Mm-hmm. It keeps track of the ticks while it's sleeping.
Okay.
Yeah. It just doesn't have any input, output. It's not doing any processing. So the ticks calculation is actually on a separate kind of piece of the processor, if you will.
That
yep. Yeah, this is only going to be accurate. I mean, the highest precision you can get is probably 0.02, right, seconds, because you have those delays in there. Questions about this algorithmically? Questions about the code here? I'll sync this when I get back to my office.